Is open. Good morning, everyone. A couple of work sessions today on 1507 will not be moved, but we're going to talk about it, and then we'll take up 1565. So let me go into a work session on Senate Bill 1507. Chris Allenack is here. He's been working the numbers to give us some more options and some things to think about on digesters and film credits. So, Chris, I know you've been putting on the green eye shades and sharpening the pencil.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just to talk a little bit about policy options that you have before you in terms of the timing of the impact. The film and video credit, the increase from a $10 million cap to the $14 million cap, so that $4 million increase is it causes that $3.5 million revenue loss in 2016-17. And then continuing out for those years. The reason for that, the timing of it, is that the way the bill is currently crafted, those additional $4 million in tax credits could be sold this year, and then they would apply to tax year 2016, and they would be realized in, to be a little extreme, on April 15th of 2017, and that's why the impact would occur in that year. A policy option for you is the timing of that increase. If that increase were not, it didn't happen until, say, the summer or fall of 2017, then the impact would first affect the 17-19 biennium. Basically, those revenue impacts, the 3.5, 3.9, would be all shifted to the right by 1 year, is conceptually what would happen. So you do have that timing before you. You also do have some options around the amount of the increase. It's not necessarily $14 million or nothing. You could phase in that increase, but you would want to be aware that the other main part, other main policy in that bill is how those funds, how the revenue raised from the funds raised from the sale of the tax credits are used. There's a distribution where some of the money gets dedicated to local projects, and so there, those two, the increase in the pot and the dedication to local projects, probably go hand in hand somehow in terms of that revenue sharing. So that would be the other policy piece you would want to consider. So you do have the timing and the amount that is available to you for policy levers. For the biomass project, the revenue impacts after 18 are pretty well fixed in terms of it just being an extension, although you didn't have to extend it for the number of years that are in there. You can extend it for any number of years you would like. You can also change the rates. Right now, I believe it was the proponents suggested having it a 3.5 per wet ton starting in 2017, which is the cause for that revenue gain. You could have it start in 2016 to raise a little more money in the current biennium, the 15-17 biennium, to help offset other costs if that were palatable to the committee. So those are a couple of the main policy options before you in terms of the levers that you can pull on those, on at least on those two main tax credits.
All right, and this is the table that's from last week, right?
Correct.
So we might be able to see some of those next few days. Any questions of Chris? Okay. Well, I appreciate that update.
And if I could add one more thing, in sure. OLIS there is another table that is kind of become a standard tax credit listing. Now the numbers in here are a little bit old, but this shows all of the tax credits that are currently active and when they sunset. So we get a lot of questions about other tax credits that could be modified in terms of revenue impacts. So this is just a standard table, and the revenue impacts here are the cost of extending. That's how this table normally gets used, but it is a handy two-pager that lists all of the active tax credits. And I think it's getting pulled up there now. But this is what we'll hand out when we get questions from members or the public about, well, what tax credits are in play, what can I look at to either raise some revenue or modify other policies to basically trade off revenue impacts among tax credits. So this is just a listing for the committee's review.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1507 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1565. And let's start with a presentation on where we were and where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. Yeah, Senate Bill 1565. So we have a dash 5 amendment. And I believe we might have posted the dash 4 as well. There's only a one word change between the dash 4 and the dash 5. But the dash 5 amendment, the underlying, just to refresh the committee briefly, the underlying exemption that was being created in SB 1565 was a property tax exemption for industrial property owners of placing new industrial property improvements on the roll. And the underlying exemption is still relatively the same. There are some changes in the Dash 5 amendment, so I'll go through those. The first change is related to the exemption itself. So the committee will remember in the previous discussions, it was this idea of the standard language, or I should back up even further. Really, the exemption in there is there's some standard language, but it really is it's a permissive tool that gives flexibility to the local governments. So there's the standard language for the exemption, and then there is flexibility for local governments to deviate from there. But the standard language now has been changed from this stair-step approach, which in the original language was, you can think of the exemption was 100% in year one, 80% in year two, 60% in year three, and so forth. The new language in the Dash 5 would be that this exemption, it's available for up to 5 years, but the standard language is it's a 100% exemption for any three of the 5 years. So it could be years 1, 2, 3, it could be years 1, 3, 5, however the city or the county want to adopt the ordinance or resolution. But that's the change one. There still is flexibility for the city or the county to deviate from there. They can still do the stair-step approach if they see fit. It does allow the city or the county in the ordinance or resolution to also specify the exemption can be up to the full 5 years. So they could do a 5-year exemption at 100%. So there is flexibility in there. One of the changes was it does require the governing bodies representing 75% or more of the total combined rate of taxation to more or less opt in to the exemption. And before in Senate Bill 1565, is the county or the city could first, they adopt the ordinance or resolution, they're allowed to more or less give up their tax revenue, and then other districts could come in and say, yes, we agree with that. Once you got to 51%, it became an all exemption. Where now, the ordinance or resolution can be adopted, but it doesn't become effective until 75% of the districts come in on board. And at that point, it becomes a 100% exemption from all the districts' taxes imposed. So that's one of the differences. Another is to deviate from this 100% RMV exemption for any of the 3 years, the city or the county would have to receive public testimony from the county assessor regarding the cost and administrability of the proposed terms of the exemption. So that's a new change. And then the other two major changes that I'd highlight is an application fee is now required for the county or the city when they're processing the application, so it'd be equal to the cost of processing that application. And the Dash 5 also allows the assessor to impose a fee equal to the actual cost of administering the exemption or deferral of the qualified property. So those are the major changes. We do have the paperwork if you want to discuss that now or later.
You have a new SMS in here. In fact, it's actually dated February 12th. So
I do, yeah.
Maybe we've traveled in time.
Well, we do have, Mr. Chair, it might be, we do have this up for work session tomorrow as well. Nice. So that could be why it had both dates there.
And the biggest difference from the measure we looked at in 2015 is what then, besides permissiveness?
From going back to the one in the 15 session, the 938. There's been a number of changes at that point. I would say the largest are changing the standard of the exemption. Rather than having the standard be the stair-step approach, it is to be a 100% exemption. There were some tweaks in cost of the initial investment rather than value, but that's for just the initial qualification to try to streamline that, make it more of a visible, accountable number rather than a value number. And then I would say it's the input from the local governments as well. So before, it was the county and city could put this out there and then it was a 51% threshold to make it an exemption from all districts. We're now at 75%, so that's a much different figure. When you look around the state, effectively, school districts in most cases are going to qualify more than that 25%, so they, in a way, have almost control of opting in or opting out, or even allowing this exemption to go forward, not even just for their own.
Can you explain that, the nuance in that 50 to 75?
Yeah, so the 50 to 75, it's based upon the rate of the imposed taxes. So it's not the total of the districts, where if a property's being, say they're in eight districts, it's not that you need four of the eight to get to the 50%, but it's of the actual tax imposed. So the more you impose, the more weight you get in that. So going from the 51% to the 75, 51%, on average, you can generally get there. If you have the county, the city, and then you have the school district, you're going to come close to the 50% on average. At the 75 level, you're in, I can't say, there's nowhere in the state that you could do this, but I'd be pretty confident to say there, the chances of reaching the 75% without the school district being on board is extremely slim. So it does change the dynamic a little bit, where before, if you just got the few districts, you're okay, where in this case, it's a higher threshold to reach. Mm-hmm. And the second part is, before it was the county or the city could still provide the exemption for only their taxes they're imposing, where in this case, it's an all or nothing exemption. Either you get the 75% and the exemption becomes from all the taxing districts, or you don't. So it makes it less likely that it could be one scattered throughout, I suppose.
Other questions, or Kyle?
Mr. Chair, I want to testify down there.
You want to testify down there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Under oath, by the way. And I'll explain why. And Mr. Easton's ready for that, right, Mr. Easton?
I do have the paper.
Somebody.
Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do want to be put under oath, and that is the vice chair. I want to do that, and there's a reason I want to do that, so that you understand. There is another bill that's out there that everybody but one person, I don't think Senator Edwards was here, that I carried on the floor, carried through one of the chambers, is now probably on the way to the Supreme Court, because everybody's arguing about the intent. And this one right here is probably going to be on the same course at some point. So I would prefer, Mr. Chair, to have my testimony and explanation of the intent put under oath so that we don't have to go to the Supreme Court on this bill. So, Mr. Easton, if you would, please.
I will.
The chair has to ask for it, I think.
Vice chair under the law has
the
to.
The vice chair can.
Under the law.
Okay, The write-up we have is incorrect, is that right?
I don't know. The write-up we have from Legislative Council and distributed to all chairs and vice chairs. It's the vice chair who gets to do it.
I'm pretty accustomed with this committee. Okay.
I don't care.
And the vice chair can ask.
I don't care. For the record, Mr. Chair, I'm not doing it about the committee. I'm trying to make sure we have the right intent down, and because there seems to be, and there will be discussion and testimony.
That's fine. I don't really care.
Very well. Senator Boquist, if you please raise your right hand. Under the penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the reason I did that again, for the record, is that there, even today, despite almost 2 years of working on this and an intense amount of working on this on 938, which I'm going to come back to, and an intense amount of work by a lot of good people behind here, there still seems to be some confusion on intent. And as we all know, intent is what ends up in a courtroom. And this is, Mr. Chair, colleagues, really an extension of 938, which was a very novel approach that I introduced in the last session and previously worked on before. And that is this basic concept right here. The overall intent of originally 938, which it didn't get there because of relating clauses, and 1565 was to provide a completely permissive, completely flexible tool for cities and counties to be able to convince and work with small businesses to expand. It's not a bring new business tool in, it's existing industrial properties which have a category. That's what we've been trying to accomplish. As you know, the problem with flexibility has been brought up, and flexibility then causes complexity. Complexity causes money. So the A5s, as they sit right now, we're trying to walk down through, so, and Mr. Easton did a good job of this. The first portion of it is an exemption that is completely permissive and a model exemption. So I'm going to come back to the model. The second part of it is a deferment and a deferment option. Now, the model on the exemption, the reason we got to the model on the exemption, you've all seen the correspondence and heard the testimony, is that the original proposal, after much discussion that came out of 938, went into 1565, was this stair step that went across there. The assessors rightfully pointed out, as does other entities, that that's very hard to administer, and if you want to accomplish the same goal, you should do it, you know, 100%, maybe every other year is what they propose, which is the same, and then an option in the fifth year, or 100% 3 of 5 years, which is the same thing. That reduces the administrative cost in the model. That is only a model. Based on what the information we have, we've gone to that model, which is in the exemption. To be very clear, though, you could go outside of the model and create at a city or county a different program. You could go outside of the city and county and create a different deferment program instead of an exemption program. And these cannot be stacked either. The challenge you come into is because of home rules, we can't take the elected assessor and say he has veto power, because the thing is just going to be too mucked up and not work. But what we did be able to do is look at this and say, in order for a city or a county government to go outside of the model, that is, create its own exemption program, which provides the flexibility. I've heard correspondence from some cities that say we like it this way, and then the city of Wilsonville came in and said something else, and we'd like to do it that way, which is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a tool for local government. Because of home rule, though, the best we can do is do the same thing that we experience in this committee, and that is require a city, government, council, our peers, our elected peers, or a county commission or judgeship commission in the home rule laws to have the assessor come in and explain to them the same exact problems we all heard, that if you do it this way, this is going to create a bloody nightmare, or it's going to do this or just going to do that, and make those decisions be made at the local level. So in the non-model for the exemption or the deferral, it does require the county assessor to provide public testimony or the whole thing is null and void. That way we ensure the assessors have the input, and that the decision makers then have everything they need to understand that this is going to be hard to implement, it's going to be costly to implement, and so on and so forth. It is pushing home rule, home control, and local control down to the bottom level across the board. Let me address the 75% rule. In the Brownfields bill, which is the other model for this, we don't have very many tax bills or tax exemption bills in which we go above 51%. It's generally the 51%, and that means that 51% of the taxing districts, schools, counties, water districts, soil and water commission, if we had them, children's districts, would all have to, 51% would have to agree to this. This goes to a 75% threshold. And once again, this is completely permissive. How I would see this working, in all actuality, is just the county and the city may not do anything to start with. You may find one of these several thousand and really only primary 800 industrial properties thinking that they might want to expand. Their associations and individuals know this law is out there. I actually think the implementation will be those businesses and entities, whether it be wineries or fruit packing plants or a construction or a manufacturing facility in Hillsborough, would go to the council and say, hey, would you consider adopting this? And the footwork's probably going to be done by the private sector, going around to the school district and saying, this is what we can bring to the table if we're able to do this. And the reason we want to be able to do this is because the financing system remains so poor out there for these smaller businesses that they can't afford to do these projects. If they could afford to it, we wouldn't give them an exemption. If I was the city, I wouldn't give them an exemption. And if I was the county, I wouldn't give them the deferment. But that's the reason for the 75%. And again, Mr. Easton is correct. We looked at almost all cases around the state, and you're going to have all your major financially impacted districts that would have cost, like a fire department, like a school that's in this, they're going to have to be part of the 75% in order to get to the 75%. And I cannot say under oath that 100% of the time, but in every single instance that we looked at in multiple counties across the state, urban and rural, you couldn't get to 75% without the key players. So you're not going to have a fire district who ought to have money to build, have a ladder truck to go to five floors because of this new project, but they're not going to get that money. That's the intent, again, across the board. Again, colleagues, what we're creating here is permissive and complete buy-in above the 75% mark, and we want to ensure that all the elected local governments entities, including the sheriff, or excuse me, including the assessor, right, has input as a community to this decision. Everybody. There remains to be, I will say, equal support. There remains to be concerns. There remains to be equal opposition and equal support and equal disgruntlement. And to me, in this building, gentlemen, that makes a good bill because we've now got everybody kind of across the board here in this spectrum agreeing that we do need to do something. I will refresh everybody yesterday that the economic forecast, you know, appears on a general broad sweep that things are doing well and economic days are here again and we might even be in Shangri-La. But I think the questions from majority and minority members, Democrats and Republicans, the committee pointed out that it's just not that way in spots. You have these little areas that still need to be helped and still need to be able to help themselves. And again, that's the intent, is so they can help themselves instead of one, blaming us for not doing anything, or two, saying we didn't give them the tools. And with that, I would be happy to take concerns and questions to ensure that, you know, if this spins out of control, that the judge has it on record.
Questions? I think you had us at hello.
Very thorough.
Thank you, Mr.
Very
Chair.
Thorough.
Questions of Kyle or any questions about the Dash 5 amendment? If not, then Mr. Vice Chair, I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment dated 2/9/16 into SB 1565.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 5s into Senate Bill 1565. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none. Motion passes.
We're going to do public. You just want to move? I'm game. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move SB. There's no referral, is there? No. I move SB 1565 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 1565 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1565 moves to the floor of the Senate as amended, and Senator Boquist will be the carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I will remain in the room if anybody has comments they want to bring to me that or more concerns. I'm happy to continue working on rural economic development to the benefit of all five of our districts.
Thank you. Some of you may have seen we received the housing bill number. Yeah, because it has some taxes in it and some tax implications. And so we're going to take a look at that. So we have some homework for you in the next few days. Dr. Warner?
Well, Mr. Chair, does that have tobacco and smoking in it too?
That's what I made the joke first. So.
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Just on the scheduling, you are posted for tomorrow, so I'm assuming you don't. We will not have that meeting tomorrow.
We don't have any. We don't have those bills other than
right.
homework.
Right. So we can post for Monday.
Yes.
And we'll post the new bill. You also have a bill that should be here early next week from the House on the Reconnect. So that's something that you'll have for next week as well, okay. Along with 1507.
You okay with not meeting tomorrow?
Sure.
Okay.
I got to be here anyway, so.
Okay. So. With that, if there is no other business before our committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Kyle.